You're listening to a Bookmark podcast. For rights reasons, we've had to shorten or omit some of the music chosen by our guests, but we hope you still enjoy listening.
Bookmark with Lee Chambers on Cambridge 105 Radio.
With Heffer's Bookshop, the great Cambridge bookseller since 1876.
Our aspirations, rather than books.
Hello and welcome to Bookmark on Cambridge 105 with me, Lee Chambers. This is the show that talks about books and writing with a local slant. Our studio guest today is writer and comedian Rory McGrath, talking about his two memoirs. We'll also hear from Cambridge academic Stefan Collini on his book of essays, and we'll be chatting to poet Michael Brown as well. Rory, welcome to Bookmark.
Well, thank you for having me.
It's very nice to have you here. We're going to give you a proper introduction in just a moment. I think already I've got it wrong. Didn't I say your name wrong?
Well,
is it Grath?
Some people say McGrath, some people say McGrath. The Irish say McGrath, you know, so.
McGrath.
That's quite good, yes.
Yeah, I'll maybe try that one.
Into an Irish accent every so often.
Well, we're talking to Stefan later, who's a professor at Cambridge, and Michael Brown will talk about how Cambridge has inspired his work. You live here now, and from what you've written in your two memoirs, which we'll be talking about, you love Cambridge as well.
Yeah, in fact, you talk about Heffer's bookshop is virtually a character in my first book, because that bearded tit, which is where I met, spoiler alert, the girl who is now my wife.
Yeah, she spent a lot of time in and out of Heffer's, didn't you?
Yeah, and I eventually got banned from Heffer's because I used to buy a lot of books on account and never settled my account. I probably still owe them some money.
Happy days.
Happy days, yeah.
Because you're not from Cambridge, are you? You're a Cornish lad.
I was born in Cornwall, but my parents are from Lancashire, so I don't feel particularly Cornwall. I have a strong affection for Cornwall, my native county, but I when I was growing up there, I was considered a bit of a northerner, you know, because my parents are from St Helens in Lancashire. And I had a slightly sort of Merseyside-light, Scouse-light accent, you know. I couldn't say, I used to say things like glass, path and bath. I still do.
Half past ten,
yeah. But in Cornwall they said, hey, I don't need talk proper. I need talk like ah, and not proper like what we talk, which I didn't understand. So what happened was I lost the Lancashire overtones, but wasn't there long enough to gain the Cornish overtones.
And you came to Cambridge to study. Is it true, I hope it is, it's in your memoir, that you came here for the footlights?
I came for the footlights because I thought in those days that's the only way you could get on into comedy on radio or television, because I was a big fan of I'm sorry, I'll read that again, which was a sort of very ex-footlights radio show. But actually, when I got to Cambridge, footlights paled into insignificance, you know, next to things like drinking and women.
Well, we're going to be talking a lot about drinking and women, because you talk a lot about them in your book. But we'll hear your first choice of music now, which is Ben Folds Five, One Angry Dwarf and 200 Solemn Faces. Why this one?
Well, I mean, I do worship music. Music is, for me, the only form of art. You know, I know I shouldn't say that on a writer's show, but I just think it's the best thing. You know, I've listened to music all the time. I play the guitar averagely. And my associations are with people, really. And this particular track reminds me of my son, because I'd never heard of Ben Folds. And Joe, my son, was learning to play the guitar. I was teaching him, and he kept coming up with these amazing new tracks. And Ben Folds, I love this. And I always think of Joe when I hear this.
That's One Angry Dwarf, still going there, and 200 Solemn Faces by Ben Folds, the first choice of music on Bookmark today from our studio guest, Rory McGrath.
Now, tell me, Lee, had you heard of Ben Folds before?
I had.
Oh, you see, I had never. I've never met anyone who's heard of him.
Yes, but there's Ben Folds and there's Ben Folds Five, I think.
Right, okay.
I think sometimes he's solo and sometimes he's with five.
Am I right in thinking there are no guitars in the Ben Folds Five, which is quite unique nowadays?
My knowledge does not go that deep, I'm afraid. Let me give you an introduction.
Go on. You know, I was going to say, that reminds me, I like that song particularly. Not only did it remind me of my son who introduced me to it, but it reminds me of my one-man show, which I did a couple of years ago, sort of stand-up memoir type show. And And when it was going particularly badly, I did think, you know, one angry dwarf and 200 solemn faces.
What, you wouldn't give to see them in the audience? Okay, Rory is a writer and comedian. He co-founded Hattrick Productions and was a regular panel member on the quiz show They Think It's All Over. His comedy writing credits include scripts for Frankie Howard, Not the 9 o'clock News, Alas Smith and Jones, and Who Dares Wins. The first volume of his memoirs, Bearded Tit, was published in 2009. It detailed how he became a birdwatcher while falling in love and having his heart broken by the woman he would later marry. The Daily Telegraph called it lyrical and beautiful. The second volume, The Father, The Son and The Ghostly Hole, came out 2 years later. Continuing the story, it also examined his relationship to Catholicism and, more specifically, sin. The Guardian called it painfully true.
Good old, oh, I didn't know I had something nice written about me in The Guardian.
Yes, there you are.
That's a very good summing up, Bertley. Thank you for that.
Well, let's dissect that painfully true, first of all. We'll come back to the painfully. It's very candid. Is it true?
Yeah, largely true. I mean, The Bearded Tit is, I mean, yeah, everything that's in both books is true. But if I've taken any liberties, it's with the timeline, really, because it's too complicated to write literally. You know, I have compassion for my readers, for both of them, as I said. So I want to make it as simplified as possible. So, but I mean, in general, the events and the people, although some of them had to be changed for legal reasons, the names. I mean, it's true.
And it is painfully true. It's very, very candid indeed. Not always to your benefit. Why did you decide to put all of that out there?
Well, I mean, I think if you're going to be truthful, you've got, I think, two things. I think the truth is more interesting, you know, and you just got to sort of, you know, steel yourself and say, you know, I can't portray myself as a hero. I mean, you can't be the hero of your own book, really, can you? Because you have to be the worst person in it, you know. I mean, it would have been very tempting just to slag off other people in my life. But I think, you know, if you're going to do that, you've got to slag yourself off as well.
Oh, there are moments in there you talk about sexually transmitted diseases, about letting women down, let's put that kindly, about accompanying a girlfriend for a termination only to forget her name. I mean, they are, you know, almost shameful episodes.
Yeah, but I mean, yeah, those bits were quite difficult to write. You know, the termination one is difficult. That was horrible. And that's so tied into being a Catholic, you know, what they teach you. But I thought, well, you know, once you set out on that road, you've got to do it all, haven't you? You know?
Well, why did you decide to write it at all? Why did you set out on that road?
Well, when I wrote Bearded Tit, the editor basically started off. He wanted me to write a book about, you know, it was that kind of based on Nick Hornby's Fever Pitch. It's about a football fan, an Arsenal fan, coincidentally, but it's also about the misery of his parents' separation, etc. Well, and the attendant misery of being an Arsenal supporter, but that's another story. There was a cult of books like, let's get somebody who's known for something and let him write about something else. And I was interviewed somewhere, and I said I wanted to do a program about bird watching with Bill Oddie. Bill would be the sort of the senior expert, and I'd be the keen student, and I suggested it should be called Bearded Tits, because after the very pretty bird of the reed beds, and someone picked up on this and said, why didn't you write a bird watching memoir about being but about your life, but you know, how it's reflected in your hobbies, etc. And I started writing this book about bird watching. It was so dull, you know. I thought, this is just terrible. I can't, you know, because bird watching is one of those things, you know, it divides people, isn't it? You know, into people who hate bird watching. No, it doesn't divide people, does it much? Bird watchers and people who hate it. And so I thought, this is just too dull. It's too anarchy. So I thought, I started putting more of my personal story in, and remembering that the girl I met in Heffers was interested in birds and birds' names and being outside, and I thought, I should just make it more personal. And so the second book, which is about Catholicism, just continued that theme. So I'd already set out on the road of being honest about myself and about my upbringing. In fact, ironically, the editor didn't like the idea of Catholicism. He thought it was a a bad idea, a bad road to go down. But he was overruled by his firm, and I quite like the title. That he hated the title.
That's a good, and I learnt a lot about Catholicism, I have to say. It's very good. Educational.
So you're not a Catholic yourself?
I'm not a Catholic myself, no.
Doesn't make you a bad person, being a Protestant.
Thank you very much. Thank you for your forgiveness. Let's rewind a little bit to some of those writing credits that I mentioned, because you have written for some great comedians. Frankie Howard is one of the names that springs
Frankie.
I mean, I guess working with somebody like that, you learn a lot about the craft.
You do, yeah. Well, think about Frankie Howard preceded hashtag me too. Yes. Otherwise, I'd have some very interesting stories to tell you about Frankie Howard. No, it was a baptism of fire in a way, because that was my first professional job in comedy after leaving university. He hated university times, Frankie. He hated Oxbridge people, you know, because he thought there were two sorts of writers, people from Cambridge and people from Oxbridge. That's what we were dealing with Frankie. And it took us a lot. And everything he wrote, he hated, you know, and said, this is rubbish. And we learnt from other writers who write for him, like Martian Renwick and Barry Cryer and David Nobbs and all those writers, that he was like that with everybody. He just hated new people and would give them a very, very hard time. Until they either stood up for him or resigned, you know. And it was me, my Griffiths Jones, Clive Anderson, and Jimmy Melville were the team of his writers.
And is it true that all the oohs and ahs and the asides that look so improvised, were they all scripted?
Well, a lot of them are. He used to throw them in occasionally where he didn't need to. But you did have to put them in the script, yes. Oh, no misses, yeah. But so we had four mouthy people who wouldn't stand up for his nonsense. He grew to like us a lot, actually, and was very kind to us, very generous, and yes.
And why comedy writing? What drew you to that particular?
I'll tell you why. I think it's my love of words and language. The you know, peculiarity of the English language, particularly, is its looseness and its ambiguity. And I was brought up listening to The Goon Show, which was a programme which ran out in the late 50s, early 60s, written mainly by Spike Milligan. And I used to love the word, the sort of the play on word humour, not puns, but just the sort of fun of messing around with language. And I thought this was great. And I started writing sketches for the school review based on this. And that's why I talked earlier about I'm Sorry That Again was in a similar vein. You know, it's verbal humour, which is why it was nice to start off in radio, because radio is a very pure medium, as you know.
I do. And how do you know when something's funny, then, when you're doing comedy writing? I mean, well, you're part of a team, I suppose it's easier, but alone.
that's the question. If it makes you laugh, it's funny. There are some things that make me laugh, and I think that could be funny because it makes me laugh. My sense of humour is so peculiar and weird that I sometimes think if it makes me laugh, it's not going to make anybody else laugh. So there's that. And there's some things I think will make other people laugh, but don't make me laugh. You know, you actually calculate that some people will think that's funny.
And the memoirs are very funny, but was that's a different kind of humour, writing in prose, I guess, than writing in a script?
Well, I suppose, I mean, it's some of the dialogue is real, you know, and I'm quite good at writing dialogue or remembering dialogue, and there are lots of exchanges in both the books with my friends at university. The guy whom I've called Kramer, it's not his real name. I can't tell you his real name because he's now a QC, Charles Bott. Oh, I've said it now.
There we are.
and Danny comes in quite a lot, who's a close friend of mine, whose birthday is today.
Happy birthday, Danny.
He's not really called Danny. I can't tell you his real name, Johnny.
Happy birthday, Johnny.
we have this sort of quite light and witty, sometimes offensive banter. I quite like that sort of... I like writing comedy dialogue. Some of the situations are quite funny or bizarre or amusing. You know, there were things in Bearded Tit, you know, where strange things happen. The whole weekend I write about when there were too many girls.
A lot of girls in a train, falling out of a train.
That's true.
That is very funny. It was slightly shocking, but funny.
Oh, I'm glad it was shocking. I forget because these things are so commonplace to me that it's quite interesting to hear that they could be shocking, or actually quite interesting that they're still funny as well.
Oh, very funny, very funny. Poetry now. We're going to move to hear from Michael Brown in just a moment, who's a poet. Have you ever written poetry?
I've written lots of poetry, yeah.
And you shared it?
Well, poetry is one of those things, isn't it? Everyone says that, il faut mettre au cabinet, I think. So you keep it in your cupboard and don't show anyone. Everybody writes poetry. But I've written lots of songs, some serious, lots quite funny. So I like the discipline of... I mean, very old-fashioned when it comes to poetry. I think poetry should have rhythm and rhyme. It should have meter and it should scan. And I find that sort of poetry very pleasing, so...
Well, let's see what you think of Michael Brown. Michael is a researcher at Cambridge University. His first collection of poetry, The Exhibit, was published in 2014, and his second collection, Mercurial, came out in 2016. His work has been described as being full of queer spark and passion. And so I asked Michael when I met him if he'd agree with that description.
Yes, I would agree. Well, I'm very passionate as a poet, and poetry is emotion on the page and emotion in the performance as well. And I often, as a gay man, write about queer topics, if you like.
And how much does your sexuality inform your poetry?
Well, I realised recently I've been asked to judge The Wild Ones, a LGBT History Month creative writing prize in Cambridge. And actually, yes, it's strange. I don't think of myself as a gay author, but others do brand you an LGBT author. I actually had a conversation with Ali Smith about this, about the pros and cons. But actually, I think it's quite important as a gay married man. Someone said to me, there's not many gay married men who've wrote contemporary poetry. So actually, you become a voice representing a certain aspect of the community. So I feel honoured and also a pressure to make sure I'm representing diversity well.
And another quote on your website comes from Sigourney Weaver, who said, "My new favourite pastime is listening to Michael Brown read his poetry." How did that come about?
Yes, Sigourney is a good friend. I was, for a year, the access officer at the Cambridge Union Society, so Cambridge University's biggest members club. And as a perk, they said, you can choose a speaker event, we'll go for a dinner. So I chose Sigourney Weaver. We took her out on a tour of Cambridge. I've worked as a walking tour guide for 5 years, so I took her around Trinity. And we went to Jamie's Italian for 3 hours. The following day, she was going to Kensington Palace to have lunch with Duke and Duchess of Cambridge, of course, and she had the morning to fill up, so I suggested we went punting. So the following day, I took Sigourney Weaver and her husband, the theatre director and New York sports commentator, Jim Simpson, out punting on the River Cam. By the time we got to Quayside, the paparazzi followed us for the whole morning, and the pictures ended up the next day on the cover of Hello magazine, the Daily Mail, everywhere, basically. It kind of went viral. And yeah, I had lots of attention following that. Sigourney, for her YouTube channel, recorded me performing poems on a punt on the River Cam. And she was one of the first people to review my second audiobook. She mentioned my audiobook in an interview when she was on the set of the TV show The Defenders. She was asked what she was doing on set, and she said she was in her trailer listening to my audiobook.
How lovely. Well, we talked about how your sexuality influences your work. What else inspires you to write poetry?
I think Cambridge is a very inspiring place. I've been here for 7 years. I'm originally from Manchester. But yeah, Cambridge is a great place to be as a writer. There's many great festivals here. So the Cambridge Literature Festival, of which we both work at, and Cambridge University Festival of Ideas, where I've curated poetry tours for the last 3 years. Grantchester in particular is somewhere that I go. I'll cycle there on a day off, and it's somewhere that I will write. I think the rich heritage in Cambridge of authors that have been here, just Cambridge is such a beautiful place. There's so many nice places to work as a writer. I often go to where the market is on Saturday on Trinity Street. Not on a Saturday, I go during the week and sit there and write as well.
And it's poetry that you write. Why poetry? You're not drawn to novels or short stories?
Well, it's funny enough, I am actually changing now. I am doing a science fiction novella. So science fiction is now something that I'm moving into. But yeah, I mean, I've been a performance poet for, a long time. I first started writing at Sixth Form College when we had a creative writing group on a Wednesday afternoon. And I had a close friend at college who died of cancer, Paul, and it was one of his final wishes to have me read a poem at his funeral. And after that, it became more serious, and I realised that actually poetry played an important role at key times in people's lives. I've had people borrow my book from Cambridge Library and say, oh, I used a poem at a wedding or a funeral. So, yeah, from being published onwards, it became more than just a hobby, if you like.
And you perform your poetry as well. Do you write poems specifically to perform? Is it a different process when you're writing a poem? Do you think this is a page poem and this is a performance poem?
It's interesting. In Cambridge, there's been a lot of discussion of, am I a page poet or am I a performance poet? I think I do have show pieces. So I did a show at Edinburgh Fringe once called Gay Pregnant Man, and I kind of wrote poetry performance, which was more cabaret style and very camp as well, which I wrote for performance. And yeah, often with poems for my book, it is meant for the page. However, I am an audiobook author, so now when I'm writing, I often think about poems for the audiobook as well, for them to be listened to, not just read or heard in performance. So I think some verse does better on the page, and I think particularly shorter pieces, which my second collection, The Exhibit, lots of the reviews mentioned the short haiku style poems as the most favoured in the collection, do work better on the page than in performance.
And what poets inspire you?
Well, my favourite poet is Charles Baudelaire. The Flowers of Evil in particular was a collection that had a profound effect on me. John Cooper Clarke, being a Northern lad myself, he's an inspiration in terms of a performer. A huge fan of Rosie Garland. She's done exceptionally well now as a novelist, actually, but I've known Rosie from Manchester for a long time. And I think as well, it's not just about poetry for fame, because believe it or not, even if you're doing well as a poet, you don't make that much money. And fame in poetry is quite small in comparison to, say, mainstream authors. A poet that's been a big inspiration to me is Jerry Potter. He used to perform as a drag queen, Chloe Poems, and he was one of the contemporary poets in Manchester that I found, which to me, poetry went beyond just being something that you learn at GCSE at school, and it could actually have a profound effect on people's lives. And I found this myself. I once performed at Manchester Pride and had a group of young people come up to me afterwards that were deeply moved by a poem, and they actually sort of followed me around for the rest of the afternoon, so it obviously did have a big impact. And yeah, he was quite an inspiration. You're often writing for an audience, or you know, you're discussing things that other people won't dare speak, so I've been told.
All right, well, you're going to read some poems for us now.
So this is from my second collection, The Exhibit, Cambridge Pace. Mark your arrival, bicycle bell. Student crime, library fine. Strolling on the common, punts stretch out like swans, rowing rivers of opportunity. Education celebration. Grade 1 listed buildings, sky-high college ceiling, a philosophy thinking, bridge of sighs, never lies. This poem is from my third published collection, Mercurial. Holland Park, Kensington. Sitting as summer sun finally rises to gently kiss our faces, opposite me on a bench, in shade, an elderly lady studies her smartphone through a large magnifying glass. Summer has started, I say. I'm busy on my phone, she replies.
The Exhibit and Mercurial by Michael Brown are published by Silverwood Books. You're listening to Bookmark on Cambridge 105 Radio with me, Lee Chambers, and our studio guest, Rory McGrath. Rory, there's a lot in your memoirs about, well, let's cut to the chase, about alcohol, sex and women. Lots of women. Lots of sex, lots of alcohol. Were you keeping count?
I don't think there is a lot of sex. And the point of it is there isn't very much.
There's lots of attempts at sex,
exactly,
that's true.
I think that's the point. You know, there's one particular weekend which accidentally, the events conspired to mean that I was with four different girls over the course from Friday to Monday. But that was a complete fluke. And it was bad planning, really. But you know, that weekend, which still makes me tremble with the fraught stress of it, was so rare and so, you know. But I'd known blokes have before and since then, who I think, oh yeah, you know, they just have. And I thought, how do these men get all these women? You know, and that weekend. It's supposed to sort of magnify the sort of rarity of sex. You know, I was always trying to, you know, and in Cambridge in the 70s, there weren't many women around.
It gets you into a lot of situations. Your libido, I think it's safe to say. Did you? Was it therapeutic writing it down? Did you discover anything about yourself for reflecting on it?
Nice of you to mention my libido. God, that's going back a long time. How would I add to that? Yeah, and no, not really. To me, it's rather pathetic. I hope it doesn't come across boastfully. It was just rather, incompetent, really. And I think, it highlights, I suppose. I was writing that in mainly 2008, the first book, and that's about the mid 70s. So, what I noticed now is how men and women, it was us and them. It was still the days of you go to a party and all the men would be in on one side looking at the women, and there was that sort of awkward, horrible. But nowadays, I know through my children, it's men, girls and boys mix, you can be seen talking to a girl because they're your friend now.
Would your life have been different now if you were young now?
No, I would have messed it up in a completely different way, I'm sure.
You think you still got into trouble? You can't help yourself, it seems to me.
It's not deliberate. It's not. I was trying to think maybe it's the Catholic. I think there's something about being brought up Catholic which sort of dooms you to be attracted to sin. You know it's bad, and therefore it becomes all that sort of Tourette's thing of shouldn't really do this because it's dangerous, and you get attracted to it. In fact, I can usually tell if I'm talking, especially someone my age, a man, whether they're Catholic or not. There's something.
There are different forms of sin, though. It seemed that you were particularly attracted to women. Sins associated with women.
Yeah, lust is the one of the seven deadly sins, because I think I do in the second book, which I haven't read for many years, so you've got an advantage over me there. I go through all the seven deadly sins. Lust and gluttony seem to be the ones that I found easiest to write about,
And easiest to live and partake of, yes.
And sloth, of course, which was the shortest chapter in the book. I think it was only one line, wasn't it? I got fed up with that.
We'll listen to your second choice of music now, which is The Waterboys, How Long Will I Love You? Why this one?
This is the sort of song which reminds me most of my wife, Nicola, who was the girl I met in Heffers in 1975.
This is for her. Mm.
Stars are above you, and longer if I can. She's all that I need. She's all that I need. And that's all. She's all.
Mark with Lee Chambers on Cambridge 105 Radio.
With Heffer's Bookshop, the great Cambridge bookseller since 1876.
Our aspirations rather than books.
Yes, you're listening to Bookmark with me, Lee Chambers, and our studio guest, Rory McGrath, talking about his two memoirs, Bearded Tit and The Father, the Son and The Ghostly Home. We've talked about women and sex and alcohol, the other two great themes of the books. We've touched on Catholicism and birds. We can't really do justice to either of those subjects in the time we've got left, but is it true you learnt about birds to impress women? It always goes back to women.
Well, it was, yeah. I mean, it was the girl in Heffers who we were out walking once. I mean, I knew a lot about birds because I used to draw them when I was a little boy. I was obsessed with drawing, and I ended up drawing only birds. So I'd buy a lot of bird books and copy them, and you just get to know, to recognise them. So when I saw a bird. I know where it was a dunnock or a pied wagtail or something. And this girl used to say, "Oh, that's a pied wagtail," and she'd tell me what the Latin name. And I'd never really taken on this idea of what they call Linnaean binomials. But I remember when I was copying birds out of the Observer's Book of Birds, it would say Dunnock at the top, and then the two words in what looked like Latin or Greek or something. And I didn't really understand what they were in those days, you know. Prunella modularis is a Dunnock. I know. I could see you were desperate.
Interject, yeah.
And I remember distinctly the first time we were having this sort of nervous, sort of hand-holdy walk together, there was a robin, and she said, "Oh, look, Erythacus rubicula." And I was puzzled. I said, "What are you talking about?" So that's what the scientific name for a robin is. I said, "Oh, right, okay." And so I had to then go back and learn all the Latin names for British birds, you know.
And you have an astonishing memory.
Well, I used to, yeah, until my brain went on strike.
But you were famous, I think, on one episode of I Think It's All Over, or was it QI?
I did do QI, yeah. Yeah, bird names came up rather conveniently in that, yeah. Well, sort of, but you have to be, I mean, I like, it. It's, I have a good memory for things I'm interested in. You know, like Arsenal's victories, you know. Not that there's that, not a huge list to remember at the moment. Birds, you know, and I used to do capitals, but dates of battles and kings and queens don't interest me at all. So
I suppose the Latin ties in with Catholicism and
language.
And language. And you still obviously remember all the masses and the benedictions. And
well, yeah, I mean, when the Latin mass was still in when we were young, when I first went to mass at the age of whatever, 4, it was still in Latin.
And you said when it changed into English, it felt different. It didn't feel as special.
No, it didn't feel at all special. What was nice about it, you realise, you know, everyone says, why are we having the mass in Latin? Nobody understands what it means. You know? And they translated it into English and we thought, it's not that important anymore, is it? Is that all it means? You know?
And this memory, did this help you in your studies? It must have been a benefit, surely.
Not really. I mean, I did languages. I did Spanish and French and linguistics and phonetics at Cambridge. And I suppose the common theme is words and my interest in language. I mean, I do like, I particularly like the English language. I'm biased, but I do dip into other languages as a bit of fun, you know.
Thank you. Well, you've led me nicely, actually, to Cambridge University and to our second interview of the show, which is with Stefan Collini. Stefan is Professor Emeritus of Intellectual History and English Literature at the University of Cambridge, an Emeritus Fellow of Clare Hall. He's a Fellow also of the British Academy and a frequent contributor to the London Review of Books, the Times Literary Supplement and The Guardian. Common Writing brings together a selection of his essays on literary culture and public debate. When we met, I asked Stefan what exactly he meant by the word common.
I mean it's kind of writing which is every day. It's not something special. It's the things we read each week in the papers, for example, or in periodicals. But it's also common, I think, in another sense, in that it's something that we share. I'm not writing here as a specialist exactly, and I'm certainly not writing for other specialists. But we all have this interest in new books and authors and then the way these ideas get handled in contemporary public discussion, and it seems to me that essays are a good way of getting at that sort of shared life.
Well, essays you mentioned there. Mm. What do you mean by an essay?
Ha! Well, if I could answer that, I'd have brought to an end a long line of inquiry. People have often thought about that. At its minimum, it's a piece of non-fiction prose of a fairly short kind. Beyond that, I suppose it's often got a slightly personal tone. It's a reflection. It's a meditation on something. It can be, as some of mine are in this book, meditation on a particular writer and their work. It can be a reflection on somebody's career. It's not attempting to be comprehensive and it's not attempting to be systematic. It's a sketch of something and it's done usually in a fairly conversational tone.
It's different to something like a newspaper column.
Yes. A newspaper column, I think, tends to be short, punchy, rather polemical, and of course has to be very topical, very up to date. An essay, I think, has its own chronology. It doesn't have to be about the now exactly. It can be a reflection on something published some time ago. And it's a little bit more relaxed and leisurely than a newspaper column, but a lot less systematic than a whole book or a whole entry in a reference work or something like that.
But a lot of these essays in your book are arguing a particular point of view.
I've certainly got points of view. I don't know that I would say they're arguing one particular point of view. I think essays are trying to take the reader with them. So to that extent, yes, they're attempts at persuasion. I mean, this is how I think we might now see a writer like J.B. Priestley or C.S. Lewis or whatever. So it's an attempt at persuasion, but not to enforce one overall point of view across all the essays.
Where would you find an essay if you were a reader interested in reading more?
Oh, I think there are quite a lot of periodicals now that do this. I mean, if you like the most strenuous kind, the London Review of Books would have some, or something like the Literary Review. But actually, you know, they are becoming more common, I've noticed, in ordinary newspapers. Just take one example. The Guardian has a couple of middle pages called The Long Read. That's not a column. It's not a news item. It's usually quite a long piece on some topic, sometimes investigative, but sometimes not. Sometimes a reflection, sometimes autobiographical. I think people quite often look for and respond to something which is that bit more reflective and extended than the everyday news item. And that's often what essays give you.
And what is it about this form that appeals to you?
Well, it appeals to me as a reader as well as a writer. I like the personal element. It's informal. You get a sense, I think, of where the author stands, where the author of an essay, as it were, is coming from, where these things fit into their life. I don't hesitate in writing these to sometimes draw on my own experience. And also, it doesn't bombard you with facts. It doesn't say we've got to get every piece of information about this author or book or topic in the essay. It says, here's one take on it. Here's a way to make sense of this. It's manageable. You can read it in most of these, I suppose, in my book could probably be read in 20 minutes.
And these are essays about literary culture, which is anything to do with the writing and the reading of literature and public debate. I mean, that's a very broad heading, isn't it?
Yes. Well, both of those are very broad, aren't they, really? I mean, literary culture could mean anything to do with books, the publishing of books, the reading, the reviewing of books, and so on, and authors and their careers. And public debate, as you suggest, can mean almost anything that gets debated in our public realm. It could be through the media, that's the most shared, I suppose, space, but sometimes public debate can mean in a more literal sense a debate, an actual discussion, a meeting, or something that's given as a public lecture or something like that. But I'm quite interested in the relation between those two things. That's to say, we think about some of these writers, let's say we think of somebody as a novelist mainly, but then those novelists also quite often play a part in some wider discussion. You'll notice they get called upon to express opinions about, could be morals and marriage, could be nuclear war, could be a whole range of things. And something about their voice as a novelist carries over. They're interesting or attractive, seductive, authoritative, whatever, partly because of the way they've been writing their fiction, in the case of people who are. And so it's that movement across from the slightly more specialised form of writing, could be as a historian, could be as a novelist, over to that more shared form of public debate.
And specialised style of writing there, what are the techniques that a writer would use in an essay?
Well, I think trying to create some sense of trust with the reader. You're not going to bridle at this. You're not going to be very sceptical all the way through. You're going to say, yeah, I hear the voice of this person. I'm willing to take this for a while. And I think that's such a fine matter of tone, often achieved by not being pretentious or not trying too hard, in fact, in some ways. You know, it's said that the thing you have to put most effort into in your prose is sounding as though you're not putting effort into it. And I think that's very true of the essay writer, that you revise and revise in order to make it seem simple and immediate. And some of the best essayists, I think, really do achieve that.
I must confess, I always think of essays as more something that maybe happened in the 18th century or the 19th century. Do you think it is a dying art form?
I don't think it is a dying art form. I think you're right, of course, that that's when the 18th century is really when it got its widest attention, and we can think of some famous 19th century essayists. But no, I don't think it is. As I said, I think in the periodicals and newspapers of today, not just in Britain, but Britain has a good tradition of this, there are quite a lot of people who still do this and think anyway of, although it's not, well, he's now dead, but I mean, think of a figure still so present for us like George Orwell. Well, now, in addition to writing the one or two famous novels and satires like Animal Farm and 1984, Orwell was above all an essayist, really, and it's his collected essays that people go to over and over again and are still, you know, very alive, I think, for a lot of readers now. So I don't think it's a dying form. Maybe it changes. Maybe the internet will make a difference. It's quite interesting to see that because the internet is not constrained by space in the way that print media are, it's allowing quite a few writers, sometimes not very well-known or established writers, to experiment with prose forms, and they write longer pieces on the internet. Now, it may be that that will grow, and, you know, if we were having this conversation in 50 years' time, maybe you'd have somebody here who had put together a set of pieces about writing on the internet in this form. It wouldn't be in a print book. Obviously, it changes over time. We're not still doing exactly what was done in the 18th century, but I think the genre itself is really very alive.
And the essays in this book, are they written over a certain period of time? How far back to this?
Oh, age? Yes. No, the essays in this book go back to 2009, really. So I wrote them 2009, 2016. And in one or two cases, that's very relevant to where an author has got to in their career at that point, or if they're still alive, or something that's happened. As I have a piece on an anniversary of Radio 4, which, you know, falls in that period and so on, because I'm quite interested in how the other media, like radio, are used by writers. It's very much of recent period in that way.
Do you have a favourite essay in the book?
No, I don't think I do, really. They do different things. One of the things somebody putting together a collection of essays has to think about is the order of them, especially which one you put first. I hummed and hawed about this a bit as I was preparing the book, but I've put first one that is on three very different characters because I think in some ways their very diversity is attractive. So I start with the essay on J.B. Priestley, and it seems to me Priestley is a figure a lot of people have heard of, not so many people now have read. He was once upon a time very popular. He gets a little bit dismissed, I think, as in a pejorative way thought of as rather middle brow. And it seemed to me there was something more to be said. So I thought, well, that's something that is more immediately inviting. And maybe one or two of the essays which deal with things people may think of as rather more academic, for example, I deal with one or two literary critics later. I put those a bit later. People have been softened up by then and then they'd be willing to come with me.
Common Writing, Essays on Literary Culture and Public Debate by Stephan Collini is published by Oxford University Press. You're listening to Bookmark. Our studio guest is Rory McGrath. Rory, we're coming to the end of our time with you, sadly, I know. What's next for you? It's been a tumultuous last few years, which we won't go into. It's been well documented. But where's that left you? What is next for you?
Well, actually, I'm writing a lot at the moment because that's basically what I am. And I've forgotten over the years that that's what I set out to be as a writer. You know, what happens is when you, I think, you start writing for other people and you start writing for yourself, and then you appear on television and you forget that actually what I do is writing, you know. And I've got several projects. I'm writing a novel. I'm a very serious novel, a chillingly serious novel. And I'm writing a ludicrously extravagant sort of gothic sci-fi comedy fantasy.
No third volume of the memoirs? You don't feel the urge to
not,
make
not
a trilogy?
Yet, no. And I'm also writing a collection of short stories. Well, I presume it will be a collection when I've written enough short stories to, because that's a form I like very much indeed. You know.
And how is it being a writer now? I mean, when you look at writing on TV now, obviously you mentioned the Me Too campaign, we've had Time's Up. There's a shift within the media or within TV about what's acceptable and what's acceptable to be written about. Can you see that?
Not really. I don't watch much television. So I don't know, really. I think it's difficult because I think television doesn't always reflect what's going on. I mean, the things like Me Too and etc. are big in the media, but I'm not quite sure whether they're that big in real life, to be honest. You know,
And what about
it's big at the Oscars, it's big on the television, BBC, you know. But actually, I think it's their obsession.
And what about you and television? Have you got anything further planned?
I've just filmed some sketches for an idea I've had, which is a comedy show which Hattrick have put some time and effort into, which may or may not take off. And I'm actually writing a comedy drama, a pilot script and treatment, which is mainly about terminal illness and death. So it should be a bundle of laughs, you know. That's what I'm doing at the moment. Yeah. So, you know, fingers crossed, you know, some things may take off.
How does your writing day work then? Do you have a set routine?
Oh, no.
No,
I really hope you wouldn't ask that question.
Kelsey surprise.
I get up, turn the computer on, and about 10 hours later, I think, oh, I better write something. This is the truth. Writing for me is a very active thing. I mean, when I write very, very quickly. I can't remember who said it, but they said, thinking is slow, writing is... Or some writer said, thinking is slow, writing is quick. And that's just me. I mean, if I have a good idea for something to write, be it a story idea or even a one-liner or a character or a poem or a song, something like that, I immediately don't write it down. I immediately go out for a walk or go out for a cycle ride or just pace up and down, you know. It's very... You know, and then I go back at the end of that excursion and just write it all down, once. Yeah.
And finally, the question that we ask all our guests: what are you reading at the moment?
I tend to read lots of books at once, not at the same time, but you know, I've got them on the go. So I'm reading a book called Admirable Evasions, which is a collection of essays by somebody called Theodore Dalrymple, which is about how psychology and psychotherapy has undermined morality and individual responsibility, which is it sounds a bit dry, but it's actually, he's a very elegant and very funny writer, and it makes me laugh. I'm also reading a book called Gut, which is by a Danish physiologist girl who's, it's very interesting, it's about the workings of the gut.
Gosh, there's something for everyone.
I'm very attached to my gut, and unfortunately. I've just finished reading Breakfast of Champions by Kurt Vonnegut, which is one of my favourite books ever.
Right.
Really love that. And I've got others on the go. I'm reading most of my reading is sort of pre-sleep, so my side of the bed has a very annoying, I've been told, pile of books. I was reading some Spanish short story. I've got what I like to do, because I did Spanish university, I like to keep in touch with it. So I like parallel text, you know, so it's a collection of short stories with the Spanish on one page and the English on. You know what a parallel text is, I don't have to explain to you, do I? And that's quite fun.
Lovely. Well, that's a lot going on there. We'll come back to you in a moment so you can tell us about your last choice of music. But before then, a heads up on what the next show contains. It's from one Rory to another, really. We've got a crime and thriller special. Our studio guest on the next show is Rory Clements. He'll be talking about his latest book, Nucleus. We'll also hear from Alison Bruce on her new novel, I Did It For Us. And crime writer Ruth Wade and Betsy Reevely from Bloodhound Books will be chatting to us too. Before then, heads up that an event happening at our sponsor's Heifer's Bookshop. Crime writer Peter Morfoot is launching his third novel in the Captain Darak series, Box of Bones. That's on the 5th of April at 6:30. If you're interested in attending that, go along to the Heifer's website. But now your last choice of music, Rory, is Teenage Dirtbag by Wheatus. Why this one?
This is for my daughter, because I remember once that I was taking my brother to Stansted Airport. He lives in Spain, and I was dropping off and took Annie, my daughter, with me. And she had this gift card or voucher for music, and she bought at Stansted, she bought this single called Teenage Dirtbag by Wheatus, and she played it in the car going back over and over again, and we got stuck in traffic, so I had about an hour and 40 minutes of nothing but this track. And I started off hating it, and by the end I thought, this is the best song I've ever heard. I think it's hilarious, clever music and the lyrics, and it makes me think of Annie, my daughter.